Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, I'm delighted to present to you Dr. Gabriel Niles, MD, has travelled many roads in his search for the ideal model of healing and flourishing. Prior to his training as a medical doctor at USC School of Medicine, he studied traditional Chinese medicine in Shanghai, China. He has organized and led multiple Circle of Healers retreats with the American Medical Student Association as a medical student, seeking to integrate the wisdom of healing traditions with modern medical science. In recent years, Dr. Niles has been integrating the insights and benefits of functional medicine into his medical practice while remaining committed to keeping medical care affordable for his patients. For this podcast, I caught up with Gabe after the Ancestral Health Symposium in LA to discuss his integration of functional medicine into his mainstream, bill-to-insurance medical practice. We talk about areas where his approach differs from that of other family physicians, including his favoring of lifestyle changes over reliance on pharmaceuticals. He also explains why he has continued working within the conventional medical system, despite rejecting the big pharma-controlled disease model of medical care. Just before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to tell you about our brand new program, Healthspan Foundations. You see, day after day, I see our clients get amazing results. However, I also get calls from clients 2 or 3 years later saying that unfortunately they've regressed. Take, for example, Joshua. Josh suffered from almost every problem imaginable. Fatigue, hormone imbalance, insomnia, digestive issues, back pain, multiple chemical sensitivities, brain fog, low libido, erectile dysfunction, and heavy metal poisoning. While working with us, Josh resolved every single one of those problems. Unfortunately, he called me 2 years later suffering from both constipation and diarrhea, as well as whole body inflammation and depression. I was super sad to hear this because I knew how hard he'd worked to get his health in order. And you know what? I've got to find a way to fix this. I want to find a way for our clients to not just get great results, but to be able to continue to maintain and improve those results without worrying about backsliding. And I want to make it a no-brainer for them. And so for the past 4 years, I've been working on just that. A way for people to get results that last and save more money on testing and supplements than the program costs. It's called Healthspan Foundations, our new group program focused on making sure every single client can quickly and easily maintain their health. Here are 6 big ways Healthspan Foundations dramatically improves our clients' health. Number 1, free blood tests make sure that nothing unexpected comes up. Number 2, dramatically cheaper supplements make sure people can afford to continually optimize their health. Number 3, free BloodSmart reports tell them exactly where to optimize their diet and lifestyle rather than just guessing continuously. Number 4, live weekly group coaching sessions with my scientific director, Megan Hall, give them the exact next steps and the accountability to make sure they happen. Number 5, access to our community makes it easy for them to answer questions by finding what worked for thousands of our other clients. And number 6, affordable access and help interpreting their continuous glucose data shows them exactly what type of carbs to eat, as well as how sleep, stress, and exercise impact their daily energy levels. And here's the best part, the way I created this, on average, our clients are saving more money on testing and supplements than the program costs. Check it out at healthspanfoundations.com. That's healthspanfoundations.com. And thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Gabriel Niles. Well, Dr. Niles, thank you so much for joining me this morning. How are you doing?
I'm well. You?
Excellent. Yeah, enjoying the autumn Santa Cruz sunshine. Whereabouts in the world are you?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Perfect. Which is where we met at the Ancestral Health Symposium.
That's right.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. It was wonderful.
We'll get into your reasons for attending the conference in a little bit. But before we get there, can you tell us about how you became interested in biology and medicine and all things related to health?
Oh, yes. That's a small topic. Yeah. Well, gosh, there's short answers and there's long answers. I'll try for a medium length answer.
Okay. Sounds good.
I've always been interested in human nature and just the way that we work as a species ever since I was young. I remember being in elementary school and really enjoying trying to help people with their problems. You know, people would come to me and like, hey, I have this problem. Can you help me? And I'm like, well, it's nothing medical, but, you know, usually had to do with the talking to bullies or, you know, whatever it was in elementary school. And so that I always knew I wanted to do something helping people. And I've always been interested in science and technology and the human body. And my dad's a doctor. That was a huge influence. So I grew up in that setting. So I knew that I enjoyed that and I had an affinity for the subject matter. But I was also really interested in alternative health. And so I wasn't really sure what field I was going to go into. And in college, I was pre-med, and I went to college in Los Angeles as well. And then I went my junior year, I went to China to study traditional Chinese medicine. And I really enjoyed that. And I liked how they took a more preventive, holistic approach to medicine. But at the same time, I got very disillusioned in my pre-med studies, and I decided to put that on hold for a while. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I wasn't ready to go into med school. And so I decided to just teach in high school for a couple years. So I taught high school science. Then after a while doing that, I decided I was ready to go to med school. And I decided that I wanted to go to allopathic MD school, but still practice holistically as possible. So I founded the Holistic Medical Student Association there at USC. And then I went to internship and residency and got brainwashed into allopathic medicine and was very much drinking the Kool-Aid for a long time until a friend of mine, who I believe you recently interviewed.
Dr. Hirsch,
he turned me on to functional medicine. And it took a while because I was very recalcitrant and, stalwart in my belief that allopathy was the way to go. And so he told me about it. I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. That's not me. Even though it clearly was, because when I looked into it, it was just right up my alley. And that's the way that I think is very holistic and root cause already. And so I did the AFMCP training through IFM, their intro course. Mm. And ever since then, I've been trying to practice as much functional medicine as I can in the setting of the allopathic insurance-based model.
I see. There's a lot to unpack there. Tell us about how you ended up in China and what did you see there? What did you learn?
Well, I did a semester abroad. I didn't want to go to like Italy or the UK and do something fluffy like where everyone speaks English and it was a Western society. I wanted a culturally challenging setting. And for me, I couldn't find any more culturally challenging setting than China. And I didn't speak the language. So I was studying the language and the culture and Chinese medicine all in the same context, in the same program. It was an immersion-based program through Pitzer College. And we studied acupressure, which is acupuncture and Qigong were the focuses. We didn't really get into the herbs and the acupuncture. But the philosophy is the same throughout Chinese medicine. And it really has to do with looking at the whole person. So, I mean, it just fascinated me, like that combination of studying the culture and learning a new language and also learning something that I was passionate about, which is alternative medicine, mm-hmm. all in one program. So that's why I picked that program.
And do you think their system of medicine works?
I think that Chinese medicine has wonderful applications for certain conditions, mostly chronic diseases, not so much the acute diseases, although it can be used fairly well as in the setting of anesthesia and surgery. I know that there have been surgeries done with nothing but acupuncture as an anesthetic.
Wow.
Which is amazing to me. So there are many wonderful applications. I don't think it has Western medicine beat in certain areas like curing pneumonia or surgeries, obviously, in cardiology, certain cardiology procedures. But yeah, for prevention and ameliorating complex chronic disease, I think it's very good.
Why is that? This is very interesting because isn't that what the allopathic model is not very good at, right? It's the chronic complex diseases, whereas they're super good. When I crash my mountain bike and break some bone and I go see the orthopedic surgeon, they're super good at that kind of stuff. And I won't die of an infection as they heal the bone. Whereas I show up and I'm tired, as Dr. Hirsch talked about, not so much good at that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's not too surprising to me because I've been doing it for a while, but I think that a lot of lay people in this country or Western countries just think that modern medicine, which is usually equated to allopathy or maybe possibly osteopathy, which are very similar, they overlap a great deal. They just assume that they have all the answers. I have whatever, I have fatigue or I have diabetes or allergies or whatever it is, IBS, that the doctor is going to be able to fix me. And that's true if you think that taking a pill to help you with your symptoms is fixing you. But I don't think that that's fixing. I think that fixing means to actually make the problem go away as opposed to just treat it with medicine. But I have plenty of patients that like the way that that operates. They have a lot of complex chronic diseases, and they have a pill for each one, and they take it, and that's easy for them, and it works for them, and that's fine. You know that, and I don't argue with them. You know, I say that, you know, if you want to get off these medicines, then I can help you do that. But if you're fine with it, then I'm not going to try to let people decide what they want to do. I give them the risks and benefits and everything, informed consent. I think it's really important, but everyone has a different opinion about that.
And do you find that the regulatory bodies that grant you licensure allow you to integrate the best of both worlds? Is that possible?
I think it's challenging, but it's possible because I do work in the insurance model. And I think that I know that the insurance model dictates the direction of healthcare to a large extent. They're very closely related to the pharmaceutical industry. And so I think that there's a push towards shorter visits and prescribing rather than trying to do what I consider to be real medicine, which is teaching people to improve their health on their own rather than to just give them something so that they get out of the office quickly. Because that's the way that the payment system has been set up in the current insurance model. But I think that it is possible to practice functional medicine because I'm doing it. It just requires more of a concerted effort. Like just mainly the way I do it is by trying to have longer visits with people. And if they can't do longer visits that day, I'll just bring them back more frequently. So instead of like, I have colleagues in the community that are charging $400 an hour and they'll do an initial visit, an hour and a half initial visit and an hour follow-up in 3 months or whatever. And what I'll do is I'll just do like a 30-minute new patient visit and then I'll bring them back in 2 weeks and do another 30 minutes. And then, you know, I'll see them as often as I need to do the same thing. It's the same amount of work accomplished because it is more time intensive to improve chronic diseases.
And are you touching upon one of the limitations or perhaps the design of allopathic medicine that, you know, the business model is intrinsic, right? When you only spend 6 minutes talking to someone and then you prescribe a drug that they could potentially be taking for life, then that's a fantastic business model versus what you've just described, exchanging your time for money, you know, an hour and a half on the initial consultation. This doesn't sound like a very good business model to me as a good capitalist.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very much the model is entrenched, and it's hard to go against that when the whole system is built on viewing it a certain way and dealing with patients in a certain way as a certain type of commodity. Yeah, it's very nuanced. It's very complex. I don't know a whole lot about insurance and the politics involved. I just know how it works on my end as a practitioner. And I can see that there's definitely a push towards seeing more patients in a day, which means shorter visits, obviously. And so to push back, I just insist on there being longer visits. I'll put in my follow-up notes. I'll say, this patient needs an extended visit. And then they'll book that, as opposed to if I don't say anything, if I say just follow up, then they're going to automatically default to a 15-minute visit.
Okay. That makes sense.
So something small like that, like just taking the small amount of effort to say, follow up for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever it is, instead of just regular default visit length.
Well, I wanted to get into more of exactly who you're practicing for and how a bit later on. But before we get there, can you tell us a bit about your time in the Navy?
Ah, Navy. So the Navy, to back up, I wanted some help with paying for the large amount of med school payments. And so I applied for and I got the Naval ROTC, Naval Scholarship, basically. It's a scholarship that they paid for some of my med school, and in exchange, I served. So I started as an intern at Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton in family medicine. And that was wonderful. I don't have any basis of comparison, but it was a pretty good internship, very well balanced. And then I had an option of either going straight into residency, finishing my 3-year residency, or doing a tour as a general medical officer, which is a special thing in the Navy that I don't think any other branch does this. That it's basically like a throwback to the old GPs before the family medicine residency. You just do 1 year of internship and then you start working. So I decided to do a special kind of general medical officer tour, which is called undersea medical officer, where I did a 6-month training in Connecticut and Florida doing undersea medicine. So that involves radiation health, submarine medicine, and diving medicine. So I got certified as a diver, and I went through the Naval Undersea Medicine Institute's course on basically training me to be the primary care doctor for special communities within the Navy that are only in the Navy. So those are submarine community, diving community, nuclear medicine, so like on carriers, and special warfare, which is like the SEALs, basically. And so that was really fun for me because I'm always been very athletically inclined. And so it was very physically demanding, not compared to like SEAL training, but like of any other physician training in the world. I think it was, you know, up there in terms of its rigor. So that was fun, you know, just, it was sort of like, it was something different. And then, so then I did, after that, I was assigned to Naval Air Station North Island in Coronado. And so I was working with a lot of flight surgeons, but I was one of the few undersea medicine officers there and ended up doing a lot of work with the divers that worked underneath the ships in the San Diego Bay. They helped repair the ships. So it was a good time. It was a lot of fun for me to be, it was great lifestyle and the location couldn't be beat. I have a lot of fond memories of that.
And who were the patients and what types of problems did they have? Obviously it varies depending on whether it's submarine versus diving, one would suppose.
Yeah. You know, the Navy community tended to be pretty healthy, especially the younger ones. They're fairly active. The older, closer to retirement or retired people definitely had the same kind of chronic health conditions as everyone else, the same Western diseases. I ended up doing a lot of physicals for young, healthy men that wanted to be SEALs that were going into the SEALs training program. And my job was to try to... Normally, when you go to the doctor for a physical, you're telling them what's wrong with you. But in this case, it was the exact opposite. They were trying to hide what was wrong with them so that they could get into training. So my job was to try to uncover any kind of disqualifying condition, which I knew that they weren't going to tell me about. So I would have to try to find it myself, either with record review or physical exam.
That makes sense. You know, and I've heard this story before. Yours is very similar to Kirk Parsley. Are you familiar with Kirk?
I do know Kirk. He actually was in my class at the undersea medicine training that we did was at the same time, exact same time.
Okay, so you do your investigative doctoring, and what do you find in these young men that are trying to hide, and women, that I assume, that are trying to maybe not pull the wool over your eyes, but hide whatever it is that's wrong?
Well, it'd be anything from maybe like a heart murmur or maybe something in the history that followed them along that they didn't realize was in there, like a history of asthma or something. You know, it could be little things, but most of them passed, you know, the physical. By the time they got to me, they were pretty fit.
And tell us about how you left the Navy. And then I believe I read a bold statement in your bio here. Early in 2017, he politely said no thank you to the big pharma controlled disease model of medical care. Tell us about that transition.
Oh, so you did see my bio. Okay. So I don't know which bio that was, but when I was getting towards the end of my tour, I did a 3-year tour, and I had to decide whether I wanted to stay in or get out. But I knew I needed to finish residency, so I had to choose between either going back to Navy residency or doing civilian residency. And I just decided at that time, because I had a young family and I didn't want to risk having to deploy, even though I hear from a lot of people that deployment is a lot of fun. At that point in my life, I wasn't prepared for that, so I decided to just separate at the end, go into civilian residency. And I was lucky enough to find an open second year slot in family medicine in my hometown of Sacramento. So I finished up there.
Okay. And so tell us about saying no to Big Pharma.
Well, I don't remember exactly what that was referring to, but I realized that there is a strong, the pharmaceutical industry has a strong sway over the practice of medicine. And one of the ways that I see that happening is, an example that I use is the statin medicines. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, I'm controversial in the allopathic world because I am not a fan of statins. And I'm also not a fan of the cholesterol heart disease hypothesis, because I've read some books and studies on that. And it makes more sense to me that inflammation is the player there and not actually cholesterol itself, you know, isolated, just cholesterol. There's other factors involved. And so my feeling is that a lot of patients will come to me, they often will say, oh, you know, I'm here for my physical, I want to get my cholesterol checked. They lump it together. It's like, I need to know my cholesterol number. I want to know, am I going to have a heart attack? And I'm trying to explain to them, well, it's more complicated than that. You know, it's not just the number. And, you know, and these drugs that are used to lower cholesterol have a lot of problems. And so I, end up explaining it a lot. My suspicion is that the pharmaceutical industry is promoting these drugs and using a lot of scaremongering tactics to get people worried about their cholesterol so that they end up going on these medicines and that the pharmaceutical companies make money. That's just one example of how I believe that, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is, because it's a for-profit industry, it's not necessarily in it to primarily for the health of the patient. They're in it for financial reasons. So I'm just skeptical. I'm a skeptic of that industry and of certain medicines in certain applications. Now, I do use prescription medicines and very often, and I just consider it one tool in my toolbox among many. I don't consider it the only tool.
And so talk about your interest in the Ancestral Health Symposium. How long have you been attending? And can you remember when you first ordered a ticket for the conference? Can you walk us up to that like it was the scene of a crime? What exactly was going on at that time?
Yeah, I remember it was probably, many months before the conference. It was probably 8 months or so. I remember when I first heard about it, it was not the first time I had heard about the Ancestral Health Symposium or that organization. But in previous years, it was in other cities, and it just didn't make sense to go to them at that time. But then I saw that it was in LA. So I thought, well, I have no excuse to not go to this. It's something I've been wanting to go to. And I knew that COVID was a thing. So I'm like, well, if they're going to cancel, they're going to cancel. But I'm just going to get the ticket and see what happens. And it ended up working out. And I'm glad that it did. But I feel like ever since I heard about Ancestral Health, this movement, I don't know where I first heard about it. Maybe from your podcast, I'm not sure. But it seems like it's a big, it's a buzzword or a popular, more and more popular these days. I just, I've always been interested in it. It seems to jive with my philosophy.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because I feel like maybe ancestral health is dying and going away, like with respect to what I saw in 2014. And in particular, the word paleo is definitely dead, you know.
Oh, really?
I think it was, yeah, it's kind of a death by straw man argument. You know, there was too many people complaining. This is, you know, not really, you know, why would we want to live like a caveman? Don't you know the life expectancy of the average this type of straw man argument. And people stopped using the word. And now all of the podcasts that I used to listen to in 2014 had the word paleo in the title have gone away now. And, you know, it's almost used like a derogatory term on some of the other evidence-based podcasts that I listen to. But I think the term ancestral health is less well known. And I think I prefer it to the word paleo because it does tend to evoke these straw man arguments.
Yeah, I can see how these terms paleo and ancestral health would have, might be somewhat of a fad or maybe in vogue or whatever. And they might, the popularity might be waning. I hadn't heard about that. The thing, I don't know what you're talking about in 2014, but I still use the term paleo regardless of appropriateness of that term. I think that the principles that it's referencing or that it corresponds to are appropriate. Obviously, I don't think that people should go out and wear animal skins and hunt with bows and arrows and
that's exactly what
give
I'm talking
up all
about.
Their technology. I mean, yeah. I think that it to me, I look at it as a melding of like, how can we adopt these principles in modern society from the point of view of optimizing health? To me, it's all about optimizing health. And I still talk to my patients about a lot about paleo diets because the diet is one aspect, but I think there's, I like ancestral health because it's more than just like paleo diet. It also incorporates other things.
Okay. And so what are the topics that you find most interesting at the Ancestral Health Symposium?
Well, I was a big fan of James Nestor's talk on breath. I had read his book already, and it's one of the, his book is on my list of like reading materials that I give to my patients. I have this list of things like my Dr. Niles health tips, you know, that I give out a lot. I add it to the after visit summary to pretty much every visit, every new patient visit at least. And it's like goes over breath and movement and footwear and diet and sleep as pillars of health and mindset. So I address what I consider to be the pillars of health and just, it's a gentle nudge for my patients to optimize these things to prevent health. So the breath is one thing. I also liked the, forget his name, but he did the hormesis talk.
Oh, Todd Becker.
Todd Becker. Yeah. And he had done one earlier that was on myopia.
Yep.
And I went up and looked that one up and I was thinking about implementing that for myself. But it's just fascinating to me, the concept of hormesis. And I mean, all the talks are great, but those are two that stand out right now.
Yeah, both James and Todd have been on the podcast previously.
Oh,
I think I've got to the point where maybe I need to reconsider my own experience when assessing the value of the content, just because I heard it in 2014. Todd has been giving talks on hormesis for a very long time, and he's very good at it. And I get it now, but does that mean that everybody gets it now? I don't know.
No, I don't think it's a common knowledge thing. I feel like I've been saying the same thing to my patients over and over again, and I sometimes wish that I had a format like a podcast where I could reach more people, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast, because I feel like I much prefer saying it once and having 1,000 people hear it than saying it to 1,000 different times to individuals. It just saves a bunch of time, and I feel like it's better for everyone. I think these concepts that you and I consider to be common knowledge or just make sense and it's obvious, I don't think it's obvious to everyone. I feel like the things I say to my patients are like, I don't know why you don't know this already, but I'm just going to tell you.
Yeah, perhaps it's because society has been atomized and none of it's taught in school, right? And it's not like my parents knew how to feed themselves, how to live. And so it's kind of up to all of us to like go out there and try and figure it out. And usually we only figure it out once we're presented with a health crisis that's sufficiently serious enough, And I think lots of people never get to that point. They feel like shit, but they don't really realize how bad they feel. And it's not that bad. But, you talk to some other people, the name that springs to mind, Mickey Trescott, has done some really great work on the autoimmune paleo diet. She's been on this podcast several times before, and she had Hashimoto's thyroiditis. I mean, she hasn't cured it, right? She still lives with the condition, but she lives a much better quality of life than she did before AIP. And she was forced into action, right? Like she's bedbound, like can't even get out of bed. And that level of seriousness forces you to try and find a solution. Otherwise, this is my life now. No, that's not acceptable to anyone.
That's the common story that I hear from a lot of in the functional medicine world is that I couldn't, doctors weren't helping me. I went to all these practitioners and I ended up having to do this on my own. I had to find my own way through this. I mean, that's Dr. Hirsch's story, and it's, so many other similar practitioners. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I never broke out and did the slightly famous podcast, write a book, health coaching thing, is because I've been blessed with pretty much good health my whole life. And I feel very fortunate that I haven't had a major illness to deal with or a major life obstacle. I've had family members that have things and that I've had to deal with vicariously, but not for myself. But I do have, I do use the things that in my life as a motivation to expand my consciousness into certain areas. Mental health is a big passion of mine. I wish that people, that it was more mainstream, some of these principles of functional medicine, which I think that when I talk to people about it, if they know about it, they're like, yeah, it's obvious, like that's the way to go. But if they don't know about it already, they're like, what's that? And tell me more. Some of them are... Yeah. I mean, I think once you explain it to somebody, if you just do these simple things, if you just don't eat this junk food, and if you move your body and you sleep well, then you're going to prevent like a huge portion of illness. And they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the types of patients that you see and the problems they face.
I'm a family practitioner, primary care. So I do a little bit of everything. I see, I see all ages, but mostly adults. Because we have 5 pediatricians next door, so a lot of the parents will bring their kids to the pediatricians. But I do see some kids. I'm mostly end up seeing in this population here. I'm in what is called Silicon Beach, the Playa Vista area. A lot of tech people, a lot of startups. Right across the street, we have Facebook, Google, YouTube, a bunch of tech companies. So I see a lot of young 20, 30 somethings with. Some are really healthy and they're just seeing me to like optimize wellness. Some have chronic diseases. And then I have all the way up to the Medicare retired community type people that have even more of a burden in chronic diseases. I have a special interest in cognitive health. I've always been interested in brain health. So I do an alternative memory care program that is very heavily based on Dale Bredesen's work. He wrote the book, The End of Alzheimer's. So a passion in memory care there. And then a lot of autoimmune and gut type stuff, IBS, Hashimoto's, fatigue, just the whole gamut. Anything you can think of, you know, walks through my door. And that's one of the reasons why I like primary care, is because it's always something new and stimulating.
And so everybody's got fancy insurance then? It's not a problem paying where you are?
Yeah. The insurance, most of my patients are PPO, although I do have a fair amount of Medicare and HMO. We don't take Medi-Cal, which is California's Medicaid program. That's not my choice. That's just my employer. That's a whole different thing. I don't understand the politics again of that, but I feel fortunate that we take most of the payers in the area. So pretty much anybody that has any kind of insurance except for Medi-Cal, we could see, with rare exceptions. And I actually really enjoy that, because I got into medicine. One of the reasons I got into medicine is so that I could help anybody from any socioeconomic status. And I feel like I can do that here. I'm not just skimming off the top of society. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think that people should, I mean, I think if you're offering value, then you should charge what you feel is appropriate. And people, if they feel they're going to get value out of it, then they'll pay it, right? I think that's, I'm a big fan of the direct primary care models and cash-based models, you know. But for me, I get a lot of satisfaction from my patients telling me, oh, I've been looking for a functional medicine doctor that takes insurance, and I haven't been able to find one. I'm so thankful you take insurance. Thank you so much. And, you know, I hope that you don't leave us and go into the cash-based world, you know. So that's nice.
And tell us about these knowledge workers. What kind of problems are they facing? You know, I've worked for some of these big tech companies that you named. Actually, none of the ones that you named, but one like it. And they tend to take this campus-based model. You know, they call the workplace the campus. And I think what they're trying to get at there is that it's all encompassing, like a university campus. And they provide the food and maybe the dry cleaning and the gym and like everything you really need to live. And so one would assume those things are suboptimal if you've still got their employees walking into your office. So tell us about the types of problems that they're facing.
Well, I don't have like large accounts like that I'm aware of anyway with these tech companies. It's usually just individuals,
of course,
that have found me on their own. But some of them will be focus issues, anxiety focus. A lot of that I see. I think there's definitely a huge surge of mental health problems from COVID, like mostly anxiety, but a lot of depression because of just whether it's from being cooped up or not interacting with people, or just fear of COVID, fear of the vaccines. There's a huge burden of anxiety lately. So the anxiety focus spectrum, I feel like they're two sides of the same coin. And so I get a lot of people that are, they can't focus because they're anxious, or they're anxious because they can't focus, you know. It's, and sometimes it's hard to tease that out. But so I deal with, I do some nootropics, try to help with brain focus, but I mean, just mental clarity. I deal with that through diet. I deal with that through supplements and medicines, prescription medicines. And then there's also like the physical manifestations of the anxiety and the stress. So in other words, like those high performers, the CEOs of the startup or just anybody in a startup is going to be super high stress because they just have to perform at a high level all the time. And it's Los Angeles. It's, you know, you got to move. You got to always be moving and shaking, or else you're going to, it's just this expectation that they have to perform at this high level. And so it ends up just manifesting, the stress of that manifests in various ways: pain, IBS, gut symptoms, fatigue, problems sleeping, you know, lots of different ways. And so I try to dive deep and figure out, okay, well, what's the underlying cause of this? And can you address it by doing some lifestyle pieces? I end up doing a lot of lifestyle medicine because I feel like that is it has such profound effects, widespread effects on health. And so that's kind of my approach, is just heavily on lifestyle medicine. And then if they need, then I'll do some gut work, help with the gut inflammation, pretty standard, you know, 4R type programs. And then I also do a fair amount of environmentally acquired illness work. I'm a member of ICI, which is the International Society for Environmentally Acquired Illness. I have been involved with them since I've only been around for a few years, but I started with them pretty early on. And they deal with like Lyme and co-infections of Lyme or tick-borne illness or whatever you want to call it. There's lots of different names for it. Mold illness, which is huge. Even in a dry place like Los Angeles, you'd be surprised at how much mold I deal with. And metals, heavy metals.
That makes sense. I was just thinking there, isn't it all environmentally acquired?
You know, yeah, I mean, that's... and I would agree with that. I think a lot of illness is, but those are sort of like these areas where we know most people agree that there's a problem, but a lot of allopathic doctors don't want to touch mold and metals and Lyme because they don't believe in it or they don't know how to treat it. They don't know how to test it. It's very challenging. There's gray areas that I'm drawn to those fields because of the ambiguity, because there's these patients saying, hey, there's something wrong with me. I don't know what it is. And no other doctor's been able to figure it out. Can you help me? And I'm like, that sounds like a challenge. Sure. Let's do it. So I have been able to help a number of people that have chronic inflammatory response syndrome from biotoxin illness, mold, chronic infections. And that's satisfying.
And so are you helping these knowledge workers in Silicon Beach overcome their anxiety? Is that even possible right now with what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of easier said than done, but I am. I mean, I think that it's really small steps. It may be just something as simple as like, okay, well, when you go home at night, you're used to drinking two glasses of wine. Why don't you do some meditation for 10 minutes before you go home or something, or maybe see a therapist and talk to them about why you feel like you need to do that. Because I'm trying to help them develop healthy coping strategies that are safe, that can replace these unhealthy ones that lead to chronic illness. So obviously, in the short term, alcohol is very effective as an anti-anxiety approach. But it's not long term. It's very dangerous. So I end up trading pieces. It's like I feel like I'm swapping pieces out. I'm like, here, this is a problem, but I'm not going to say just stop it because, again, it's easier said than done. They're doing it for a reason. So
right,
because let's swap it out with something else. Let's give you another thing to work on. And sometimes it's as simple as like, you know, changing tack a little bit, but like about lifestyle piece, sometimes it's as simple as if a patient's really motivated, I'll say, hey, you're developing metabolic dysfunction based on your markers here. This will lead to heart disease and diabetes. So you should do something about it. Oh, what can I do, doc? What can I do? Go do a Whole30 diet. Done. Okay. And then they'll see you in a month. They come back in a month. They're like, I did a Whole30 diet. I feel amazing. I lost 6 pounds. My energy's great. Thank you, doc. And then I'm like, awesome. That was easy, you know? Yeah, but then that's like the outliers, you know? Usually people are, you have to really push them into doing those changes. It's not like they're gung-ho about it all the time. So a lot of it ends up being motivational techniques. Hey, what do you want your health to be like? And how can you see yourself getting there? And what were you willing to do what are you willing to give up or what are you willing to add on to your regimen to get to that place where you want to be? You know, I try to help them visualize.
I would highly recommend It Starts With Food and the Whole30. That was one of the original books that got me into it in 2011 or 2012. And I think they're still, it's interesting actually, they didn't choose that word paleo. And so in a sense, it's become timeless, but they do have some of the best resources. You know, when someone's feeling overwhelmed by choice, both in the canteen at work and in the supermarket, you know, here are a set of rules. I can just implement this. This is easy. And you know what? The food, it tastes great. And the secret is that although it's only 30 days in duration to begin, you get to the end and you feel fantastic and it seems so sustainable and you can just keep going. And that's not so much the case with many other interventions I might, you know, could name here.
I love it. I agree. I think diet is just, it cannot be overstated how important diet is for everything. And I really like the Whole30 because of its simplicity and approachability. I use it a lot. And I actually do tell patients that this is basically a paleo diet. You know, what you're doing is a paleo diet. I've been more interested lately in carnivore as well for those recalcitrant cases of severe inflammation or profound chronic disease like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's or psoriasis, and the patients are really against taking a biologic or some kind of pharmaceutical. I know that I have an opening there. I'm like, okay, I have all these different tools. You seems like you don't want to take this medicine. Well, how about some diet changes? Would you be willing to change your diet? Okay, what do I got to do? Well, just eat paleo or eat keto or eat carnivore. There's different people respond to different things. So I end up having to try a few different things out. And some people are like, you know, doc, I can't give up my bread or my dairy or whatever it is. And so I'll backtrack a little bit. And I'll say, okay, well, maybe not the whole theory. Maybe let's try, but just start with gluten-free. Let's just go gluten-free, dairy-free. And I'm like, well, I don't know if I can do that. Okay, just gluten-free. You know, so like it's a negotiation, yeah. Right? And small steps.
And what do you do? What are the resources you recommend if you think that the carnivore diet is indicated? I'm not really sure. Is there a good book out there right now?
One of my patients turned me on to Paul Saladino's Foundational Health podcast, and he wrote the book Carnivore Code, and he also has a company selling organ meats. I might as well talk him up on my to my patients. So that's one place I start, is the Carnivore Code, because it's good for lay people. And I don't think it works for everyone, but I do think that it makes a lot of sense, again, from an ancestral health perspective, if you're looking at the, and we talked, some of the talks were on this subject of what the diet was like in the Paleolithic period, and, you know, about how we were fat hunters, you know, not so much animal hunters, but really the fat was the important part. And so for me, it just makes a lot of sense that about 70% of our diet calorie-wise should probably be animal products, and the rest should be vegetables, maybe some fruit, but not all vegetables and fruits are created equal, that some have these anti-nutrients or toxins in them that can lead to poor health outcomes, whatever, you know, there's different things, oxalates, lectins, phytates. So that means avoiding things like the seeds of the plants, grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, all those, and which, again, that's why, in my opinion, it makes sense that the Whole 30 diet is so effective, is because you're avoiding a huge amount of the seeds, which contain the anti-nutrients from the plants, the lectins, you're taking out grains and legumes, which have a lot of anti-nutrients in them, and just eating the fruit part of the plant, the flesh of the plant, as opposed to the skin and the seeds. And so there's a gradient all the way from like keto carnivore, where you're just eating all meat and maybe some eggs, to carnivore-ish, where you're adding some carb fiber containing part of the plant, you know, maybe increasing the carbs so you're not in ketosis, you know, and then it's just, a matter of negotiation and what you think is going to be the best for the patient. Mm-hmm. So those are
some references. That makes sense. And yes, I have listened to much of Paul Saladino's podcast. I've met him in person, and I agree with some of what he says. Yeah. You know, I'm worried about, you know, we've seen this before with carbs versus fat, like nutritional bogeymen. Oh, if it wasn't the carbs, then it must be the fat, or vice versa. And if it's not the animal food, then it must be the plants, you know, and life rarely works like that, but marketing does, right? Like if I'm trying to sell a book,
right,
then
I agree.
You've got, that's the polarization is really important. That's why I ask you, oh, what's the indication? And then,
right.
Yeah. So
I don't think it's
Crohn's, a panacea. Yeah, I get it, right. But
no, I don't think it's a panacea. I just think that it's, again, I used to be more black and white about this thing. Like when I find out about something that was exciting, I start preaching about it to all my patients and even my family. Like, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that. And as I've gotten more experience, I realize that that's just not helping anyone. So what I've decided to, how I approach it is that if I find something I'm excited about and it seems to work in certain populations, I'll use it as one of my tools, and I'll test it, and I'll see how it works in this patient. And a lot of it is art. It's not so much science. It's not like we have a test to say, let the patient can do a blood test and it'll tell us what diet that's going to be best for the patient. Or, I mean, a lot of people will come to me for a physical and they're like, tell me what's wrong. I want you to test everything. And I'm like, okay, well, I can tell you that you don't have leukemia. And I can tell you don't have kidney disease. So what else you want to know? You know, it's like, they think that that I can tell them everything, and we don't know everything. Right. We just know there's a small little thing, amount of information that we can glean from labs. And so, you know, I just use it as a tool, basically.
Yeah, I would caution against that approach. I think Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a really good book called Natural Causes that warns against this. You know, like you start doing whole body MRI scans, you're going to find a bunch of problems that medicine doesn't have a good solution for, but may do a bunch of damage in trying to fix it, right?
Yeah. And I end up talking a lot to my patients about, I'll talk them out of things that they want. Like, hey, I want this MRI, or I want this blood test. And I'm like, do you really want that? Like, let me explain to you what would happen if you find something, you know, that you might, you know, that's not surprising. I mean, I'm blessed. I feel like my knowledge compared to a lay person is like, before I went to med school, that gap between a lay person and what a doctor knows was huge. I didn't know, you know, it was like, oh, doctors are gods, you know? And that's what I think a lot of lay people think, that doctors know way more than they actually do. What I realize now is, I'm 15, 16 years of experience as a primary care doctor. We do know more than lay people, but it's like a little bit more. It's like a, and it's about a specific area too of knowledge. It's like you go to a mechanic, they're going to know a lot more than you about a car, probably, but that's all that, that's the, where the knowledge extends to, is just the car. And so I know about the body, but I think that that gap between what patients think we know and what we actually know is probably, it's not accurate. I mean, I do feel like it's hard to explain in words, but I don't want to make it sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, because I feel like I am an expert, but sometimes patients have a unreasonable expectation, you know, like they think we can fix everything, and that's just not how it works.
Well, my goal here on the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast, and I'm sure yours is too, is to empower people with the knowledge they need so they don't need you, right? Like, that would be ideal.
I love it. No, and that's one of the reasons why I love your podcast, is because I totally identify with that. And that's my philosophy, is like, I would love nothing more than to just put myself out of business. That's my goal. I don't want to be creating, I don't want my patients to be reliant on me. I want them to, I try to empower them. That's why I'm so passionate about teaching. I've always been, to me, that's the primary function of the doctor, is to teach patients. And what are you teaching them? Well, you're teaching them about their bodies and about their health. What's the goal of that? Well, so that they can just, they don't have to, you know, it's like they can do it on their own. They, you know, it's like give a man a fish, you know.
So there's a final question for you. Why don't you take the private practice route? Why don't you just do functional medicine full time? Why don't you do the $400 an hour thing, the 90-minute initial consultation? Why don't you go that direction?
Well, there's a couple things come to mind. One is that I'm passionate about, I want to be able to offer services to a wide range of people from all walks of life and all socioeconomic statuses. And I really do believe that cash-based practices, although I think that that model makes more sense from a price transparency standpoint and from the standpoint of accountability, that there are certain people that just can't afford that, and it's going to price them out. So that's one thing. The other thing is because when I started in Navy, it's basically a managed care situation, I come to work and I do my job and I leave, and there's somebody doing everything else, you know, the business aspect and the billing and the PR and the HR and all that stuff. I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And so I'm not so keen on taking all those extra roles.
Okay.
You know, of like being the businessman.
Okay.
And having to make sure that not only do I have to practice medicine, but now I have to be a businessman on top of that. And it seems like a little much for me right now. And maybe someday I might transition into more of like a consultative role. But right now I feel like I'm offering good service and I'm comfortable with where I am.
Well, I don't doubt that. I also don't doubt that some of the things that you just said are solvable problems. So, for example, James Maskell was on the podcast recently talking about the power of the group program. We've seen that in person, in real life, on, you know, with our blood chemistry group program that Megan and I run. I mean, it's fantastic. It's unbelievable. I mean, you've just said it yourself that it's not very efficient to say the same things over and over again. It's much better if you say it to more than one person at once, right? And there's a tremendous amount of overlap between the problems that people are facing. And there's a level of community and accountability that comes with the group as well. So that might be one way in which you could scale your services to make it more affordable. And then the business part, I mean, and that's a very solvable problem as well. Obviously, you've got to get help. You're going to need employees. I mean, I think that Evan has already done that, right? Like, your buddy has already done all of this. So surely he can help you with all this.
And if I was going to do the private route, I may end up doing what Evan did, which is doing the virtual coach thing. He actually has a course where he teaches providers how to switch from being conventional docs and practitioners into virtual coaches. So another plug for Dr. Hirsch there.
He's a very humble guy. He didn't even mention that when I interviewed him last week.
Yeah, it's called the Virtual MD, I think, the Virtual MD. I've actually done a fair amount of that course out of curiosity. I'm interested. I do know James Maskell. We've met, and I had been one of the founders of the Functional Forum in Los Angeles, because there was one in Orange County, there was one in just north of here, and there wasn't one in LA. And when I got back to town here about 5 years ago, and so I set one up, and that I think is still going on, probably not anymore from COVID. But yeah, so I'm familiar with his work, and I've read his book, and I do like those thoughts. We'll have to talk more maybe offline about this, what do you call it, group practice or group?
Yeah, the group program. So I did a whole interview with James on that, and he wrote a book called The Community Cure that goes into it in more detail. And I have a feeling that he might be working on resources for traditionally trained medical doctors to run group programs and still bill for it using insurance. I have a feeling I would want to check with him, but I have a feeling that's going to be, you know, the most common question is like, how do I bill for this? You know?
Well, there are group, I have looked into doing group visits. That makes a lot of sense, you know, having 20, if rather than talking to 20 different diabetics about how to lower their A1C, you know, just say it once in sort of like a group setting. There's definitely great applications for that. I think it requires like the most important thing. One of the more important things is like having the right space for it. So we just don't have that in this clinic setting, but if we had like a group, like sort of a large room with some, you know, then we can make it happen. So I have asked the powers that be to maybe create some space for that, because okay. I'd like to make that happen.
Well, in the meantime, we should be very grateful for the fact that there is a traditionally trained medical doctor doing functional medicine and who is taking insurance. That's pretty awesome. Like you said, like that's a pretty rare thing. So where can people find you?
Okay, so I don't really have my own website. I'm working on that. Someday I'll have that. You could find me, like Google me, and I'll probably be one of the top three hits. I'm with working right now with Providence Medical Doctors of St. John's. But if you just Google Gabriel Niles, MD, Playa Vista, it'll come. They have their own, like the Providence people have. I have a page where I have my bio on there and the contact info. But I'm in, I think that's probably what
that
I want to
sense.
Say about that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. I'm just thinking about 2011 me. You know, with fancy PPO insurance, working for a hedge fund.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there has to be, you know, having already seen three or four primary care doctors and them all sucking so hard, you know, and then to find one that talks like you do, that is actually taking a root cause precision medicine approach is like rocking horse shit, right? That's really valuable right there.
Well, maybe I'll give you the link to, you could put in the show notes or something.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah, we make comprehensive notes, so people will be able to find you through those. Well, Gabe, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. Will I see you at the Ancestral Health Symposium next year?
I would like to believe so, yes. I'm going to say 90% chance.
Okay, and it's at UCLA again. So
oh, well then, 99% chance.
Okay, that's great. Fantastic. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.